From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America presents Issues in the News. The nation's top Washington correspondents offer their perspectives on the week's major stories. Your moderator is Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Issues in the News begins now.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard, and joining me on the show this week are Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal, and David Rennie, the Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. And here are the issues. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry set a Monday deadline for Russia to soften its aggressive stance toward Ukraine, while German Chancellor Angela Merkel toughened her stand against Russia's annexation of Crimea by joining in the call for sanctions against Russia. Meanwhile, the Obama administration declined to send military aid to Ukraine as Russian troops massed on the Ukrainian border. In Washington, Senator Dianne Feinstein accused the Central Intelligence Agency of stealing documents and searching computers of the Senate Intelligence Committee. And in Florida, a Republican won a special election for a House seat by denouncing President Obama's health care law. Well, as you can see, just by my introduction, David, it's just going to be heavily tilted toward Russia, Ukraine, Crimea, and what goes on there. I thought the two most significant things were, one, the Chancellor of Germany, who has been really against any tough sanctions, now talking in favor of them, and also the troops, the Russian troops being moving. They claim it's just an exercise, but on the Ukrainian border. What do you make of the situation now?
Well, I think it's absolutely right to look at this shift of position from the top in Germany. Now, German public opinion is probably some way behind.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people talk about this is because Germany does so much trade with Russia and Germany buys so much energy from Russia. And there is something to that. And that's very different from America, which really doesn't do a great deal of trade with Russia.
I think the U.S. isn't even in the top 10 of Russia's trading partners.
So there are countries in Europe who get all of their energy from Russia. You know, they're heating their homes in the winter because of Russian gas. So that makes things look very different. But there's another really important kind of philosophical difference between how things are seen from America and how things are seen from Germany. In America, there's a consensus that the end of the Soviet Union and the sort of the West winning the Cold War was fundamentally because the West played it tough, that the West, particularly under Ronald Reagan, armed heavily, maintained a robust nuclear deterrent. And, you know, people will talk about Ronald Reagan going to Berlin and saying, you know, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. That's the kind of perception on this side of the Atlantic here in Washington. In Germany, the consensus among the sort of political establishment, but also public opinion, is that it wasn't toughness that ended the Cold War peacefully. It was what they call their Ostpolitik, their pragmatic, some would call it sort of appeasement of the East, their decision to avoid conflict, to reach out to East Germany, to reach out to the Eastern Bloc, to try and bring the Soviet Union into a kind of European sphere of trade and peace. So they have a fundamental problem with the idea of confrontation and toughness with Russia. So for Chancellor Merkel to be saying that she's prepared to contemplate sanctions when German public opinion has been very opposed to sanctions, I think starts to point to the fact that Vladimir Putin may be winning some of the tactical battles on the ground, but he is unifying the countries around Russia in a way that we've not seen for a long time.
Well, it'd be pretty easy to, if you impose tough sanctions, and to harm Russia economically.
Well, yes, although...
Yeah, particularly if you shut them out of the financial system in the West.
I mean, I think that you could impose extraordinary pain very rapidly on the Russian elite, because the Russian elite, you know, they send their kids to school in Switzerland and in London and they're into all the sort of smartest boarding schools in the UK, and they all have their gigantic houses in Mayfair and Belgravia, and they have their bank accounts in places like Austria. It's basically Austrian bankers and very expensive London lawyers who have helped them hide their stolen money. So you could actually, without having sanctions that particularly crippled, say, Russian industry, there are very targeted sanctions on the elite right around Vladimir Putin, that whole sort of corporate military security sort of elite around Putin, where you could really cause intense pain very fast with some targeted, you know, asset searches, some money laundering investigations, things like that.
Tom, one of the things that the Ukrainian government has done, and the leader was in the United States and talked to President Obama, was to ask for military aid specifically, and as it stands at the moment, the U.S. has said no.
Well, I think the U.S. is not interested in doing much there at the moment. I think the Obama administration thinks that would be a little bit too much of a provocation right now. I have to laugh at the meeting between President Obama and acting Prime Minister Yatsenyuk. President Obama referred to him as 10 times as the Prime Minister. I guess he didn't want to get too tongue-tied on a very difficult name to pronounce. But Obama said all the...
I can't blame him.
I don't either. But I think the president said all the right words. But I think military aid to the Ukrainian military, which even with massive American military aid would be no match for the Russian military, unless there was a U.S. intervention, which is not going to happen. I think that's a bridge too far. But I thought the most interesting thing about the meeting between Obama and Yatsenyuk was that Yatsenyuk said in so many words, we will be a part of the West. He said they're going to go ahead and sign the political document associating Ukraine with the European Union. Mm-hmm. And that's probably going to just send Putin over the wall. The other thing I think that is the most interesting development of the week is that sometimes, as we all know here, there are pieces of information that are a little too easy to get. And I thought it was a little too easy. It was a little too easy for reporters to learn in the last few days that Angela Merkel is kind of wringing her hands about being able to get to Vladimir Putin. She speaks fluent Russian, but she has not been able to get Putin to understand. And she has been paraphrased as saying he can't be reached, he's out of control or whatever. And I think the harder Merkel line is based on the fact that she has concluded that Putin is not, rather than crazy like a fox, that in Merkel's view, Putin is not behaving rationally and tougher sanctions are in order. That, I think, is a very significant development.
I guess she's concluded that he's not influenceable as a result of what she may think is weird behavior. What do you think of John Kerry's Monday deadline, which will be after the so-called referendum in Crimea? It sounds a little like the red line in Syria, and I'm surprised he would set a deadline.
Well, it probably is not smart because from the start, Secretary Kerry has talked about there is a diplomatic solution. There must be one, and we have to focus on the diplomacy here.
Well, he did say that again, but he had the deadline.
He's still saying that, yeah. But a deadline suggests the old take-it-or-leave-it formulation, mm-hmm. and anyone who knows anything about the Russians and their Soviet forebears know that that is the kind of thing that drives them crazy. So that was probably what might be called in another context irrational exuberance. I don't think that was wise, and I think the Russians will totally ignore it, especially if it seems very likely they will get the vote in Crimea going their way.
What about the deadline? What did you make of that, David?
Well, I think it's important to note that Congress, even by its own woeful standards, the American Congress did send Secretary Kerry kind of naked into his meeting with the Russian foreign minister. You know, we were supposed to have a strong signal sent by the United States this week where Congress, in collaboration with the administration, was going to send $1 billion in loan guarantees to Ukraine. There was going to be the start of sanctions legislation. This got held up in the Senate and in the House of Representatives for the most unbelievably parochial of reasons. So on the Senate side, you can criticize the government. They decided that this was a train that was leaving the station, so you might as well throw some luggage onto it. And so they had some business they wanted to do with shifting around the way that America's contributions go into the International Monetary Fund. It's actually, I happen to think, a very good idea to do this change, but they decided to throw those bags on the train thinking it was leaving the sort of legislative station. The Senate passes that because that's a democratically controlled half of Congress. The Republicans aren't interested in doing that. The Republicans then said that they wanted to attach a completely irrelevant, totally domestic dispute about how political organizations spend their money and how they relate with the American tax authorities. And then you had Republican members of the House starting to say, well, hang on, do we really want to be members of the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, at all? And I think my low point came when Congressman Ted Yoho, who is a new member of the House of Representatives from Florida, previously a large animal vet, said, I've looked in my American Constitution and I don't find the International Monetary Fund, so I see no reason why we should be members of it. Well, it's an interesting take. I mean, I've looked in the Constitution. I can't see astronauts, but we seem to have those. So that was a low point, I think, for American politics.
I've met Congressman Yoho, and I'm not surprised that he took that stand.
Should have stuck with the large animal vet side of things.
Well, he's in Congress, you know. It's a big organization in the House, 435 members, so a lot of different things can happen. What next, Tom? You know, the biggest fear, I think, of Europeans in the U.S. is that Vladimir Putin will be encouraged by having gotten away, seemingly, with the annexation of Crimea and will want some of the eastern Ukraine now.
That's the real danger. There is a theory in the U.S. State Department that all he's really trying to do is make absolutely sure that his critical Black Sea Fleet headquarters in Crimea is absolutely protected from a government in Kiev that he believes is very much anti-Russian. But let's see whether that's a fanciful thinking at the State Department or it's something else. I think Putin is going to hang on to Crimea no matter what, and basically dare the world to do something about it. And he's probably correct in assuming that the West is not going to initiate a military intervention in Crimea. The question then becomes, is he emboldened, as you say, to do the same sort of thing under the same sort of spurious rationale that he used in Crimea? In eastern Ukraine, Donetsk is a very heavily pro-Russian area of eastern Ukraine.
You mean the rationale that Russian-speaking citizens there are being abused by the Ukrainian government?
You know, not a lot of evidence for that, but that is what he's used as a pretext. Again, I think Putin is daring the West to be tough, and he's assuming that since he has concluded that President Obama, based on Syria and other places in the world, is not inclined to be tough, that there's going to be a lot of harsh words and nothing else. But I think David is right. The economic arsenal that could be deployed against Putin and his oligarch pals, who have made him a billionaire as well, those are formidable assets. And so I think at some point there are substantial tools to hurt Putin and his friends, but also to endanger the Russian economy. Remember, when this first happened, the Russian stock market dropped 10% in a single day, which if that happened in the United States, people would be saying recession, depression, and taking their money out of banks.
So. Yeah, we'd call it quite a correction. David?
I think I have to disagree with the idea that he is being motivated by a perception of President Obama's weakness. I think it's possible to believe that President Obama's foreign policy, you know, is not very impressive. You know, I think that his handling of Syria has not been impressive. But we need to remember, President Putin has done this before. He did this in Georgia, in the Caucasus, and that was when George Bush was president. And I think there was no doubt by the time that, you know, this was 2008, people did not doubt that George Bush was capable of using military force by 2008. He'd already started two wars. He had hundreds of thousands of American troops overseas. I mean, inasmuch as anyone can psychoanalyze this tiny group around President Putin, some of the most plausible reporting is that this is a president who, as he came back for his third term in office, really seems to have bought into a sort of philosophical, quasi-historical, quasi-religious, spiritual idea that Russia is this alternative civilizational path for the world, that it's a bridge between Asia and a decadent, secular, immoral, sort of rotten West, and that he represents this kind of spirit of orthodox Christian, tough, authoritarian rule, which will sort of somehow save large chunks of that sort of central zone of the world from the decadence and sort of spiritual pollution of the West. And I think that is unfortunately what's kind of playing into his decision-making at the moment, is this sense that, in fact, that he believes the propaganda that the West is always meddling. It's not so much that he's making a bet on President Obama's weakness as he's increasingly uninterested in, you know, Western claims that there are differences of opinion between a, you know, a Republican and a Democratic president. He just thinks all American leaders are sinister and in the business of regime change and cannot be trusted, and it's his duty to oppose them. And that extraordinarily sort of confrontational mindset seems to be guiding the very small inner circle around him.
It sounds like he's perhaps philosophically a little over his head in this dream of a Russia that doesn't suffer any of the moral and decadent ideas and practices in the West.
It's the classic paradox of the autocrat, that the stronger your autocracy and the more that you shut down avenues of dissent and advisors who might tell you something different, it's very hard to tell when you're making mistakes.
So what do you think is going to happen next?
Russia is surprising us a bit because, you know, the conventional wisdom among smart people who studied modern Russia is that he would not go for anything as overt as a change of regime and annexation in Crimea. You know, the take usually was this kind of legalistic deniability. You know, you see this with the Russian troops who are supposedly just, you know, guys who went to an army surplus store and bought some uniforms in Putin's own words. So there was a sense that it suited him much better to have kind of a puppet Crimea rather than an actual kind of de facto legal annexation. Because, you know, his whole shtick is that he's the guy who believes in, you know, the rule of law, and it's the Americans who are the wicked ones. He could have had that. So it's strange that we've ended up with the referendum on Sunday, the two questions on the ballot. Neither of them involves the status quo. One of them is annexation, effectively, and the other one is substantial separation from Ukraine. So the die has already been cast. whether there's a plan to take over the whole of Ukraine, you still have to doubt that. You still have to doubt that that would suit his interests. Much more useful for him to have a kind of weak puppet regime which knows that it's under Russia's thumb, that he can keep Ukraine in line without the bother of actually having to cope with Ukrainian public opinion and Ukrainian opposition.
Tom, have you got anything to add?
Well, I was just going to wonder out loud about keeping Ukraine under his thumb. How do you reconcile that with Yatsenyuk's vow that Ukraine is going to go ahead with its emerging relationship with the economic union, which, as I recall, is what allegedly prompted Putin's reaction in the first place?
I'm sure Putin will find that provocative, and we'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder, you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me on the show today are Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal, and David Rennie, Washington bureau chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues in the News online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com and click on Podcasts. It was remarkable a few days ago when Senator Dianne Feinstein of California, she's a Democrat, one of the biggest supporters and most important supporters in Congress of the entire American intelligence community, came out and attacked very bitterly the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, and accused them of stealing documents and doing other things at a facility in Northern Virginia where they were working jointly and going over a huge inventory of CIA documents. Losing Dianne Feinstein's support would seem to be, politically in Washington and in Congress, a huge setback for the CIA and the entire intelligence community, Tom.
There's no question about it, Fred. I mean, Dianne Feinstein, in the old days, they would have called her a whale or a bull, one of the real mandarins of Congress, mm-hmm. and a strong supporter of President Obama's drone attacks against mm-hmm. Terrorists. She seems to have declared war on CIA Director John Brennan, and this all goes to the point of, for 5 years, the Senate Intelligence Committee has been investigating, is in the process of putting together a report on so-called waterboarding that the Bush administration engaged in to get terrorists to talk.
This was an interrogation practice.
An interrogation technique that simulates drowning, referred to as waterboarding. President Obama campaigned against it in 2008. He said if elected president, he would end it, and he did end it. I think what's really behind this is that you get a sense that the report, which is still classified, has not been published 5 years later, is going to be quite critical of CIA sources and methods. And so you've now gotten into this situation where, as you said, Feinstein says the CIA hacked into senatorial computers because they didn't like the fact that there were CIA documents that the committee had obtained. And
that the CIA did not want the committee to obtain.
Exactly right. And then the CIA, I think what really sent Feinstein over the wall was that the general counsel of the CIA sent what's known as a criminal referral to the Justice Department saying there's highly sensitive classified information that's been obtained by the Senate. We'd like you to check and see whether a crime was committed in that process. So you don't know how this is going to come out, but you do know with Senator Feinstein on the warpath towards the CIA, and particularly with Director John Brennan, this is not going to be good news for the CIA.
Well, David, both Tom and myself have portrayed this as a huge deal. Is it really, or might it be a tempest in a teapot?
No, I think it's a huge deal. I mean, I think if you look at the long, long history of American intelligence over the Cold War and modern period, you have sort of peaks of CIA activity where, you know, the pressure is on to do more and more aggressive things. You saw this in the Cold War when the CIA started to do things like assassinate foreign leaders like Fidel Castro of Cuba. Mm-hmm. And then you reach a certain point of intensity, and Congress, which has very, very powerful oversight powers in America. Let's not forget, America has the world's most powerful intelligence apparatus, but it also has the most developed and aggressive oversight. No other country I can think of has full parliamentary legislative oversight of mm-hmm. intelligence services in this way. And in the Cold War, you saw the Frank Church, the Church Committee, you know, reining in those assassination attempts, you know, really pushing the CIA back. What you're seeing now is an extraordinary breakdown in trust. I mean, it's a complicated story, but you can simplify it. In essence, this is the legacy, as Tom says, of those Bush-era post-9/11 effectively torture programs. The CIA investigated itself, but that report was secret. Congress, the Senate, was then going to investigate the same program. And the key question here was not whether torture took place, but whether actually any useful intelligence was developed by these torture techniques. And the fundamental point is that the CIA's own investigation of itself turned out to have concluded that actually it wasn't very useful, that not only was this torture, but it hadn't generated very much. And because trust has broken down so badly, when the Senate investigators got hold of this CIA report, they took a copy of it because, as Senator Feinstein said herself on the floor of the Senate, she did not trust the CIA not to make this inconvenient thing just disappear. They had a habit of making things disappear. And it was that decision to take a copy of the CIA's own report that led to this total breakdown in trust. We now have dueling criminal investigations, the CIA wanting the Senate investigated, the Senate wanted the CIA investigated. And this is a Democratic-controlled Senate, as you say, a very loyal friend of the intelligence community, and Senator Feinstein, chairman of this committee. And it is an open goal for Republicans to push their case that this is an administration which flouts the law, which tramples the law. We're in an election year. I think that if I was the boss of the CIA, I would be brushing up my golf and preparing for retirement right now, because I don't think he's long for this official world.
I suspect, Tom, that David's right about that, that John Brennan is just too much of a, perhaps a bull in a china shop on this, to use another cliche, that he'll have to go. Although he has been extremely close to President Obama in an earlier role at the White House.
Chief Homeland Security Advisor on the National Security Council. You have to remember also that Brennan, in previous incarnations, was heavily involved in the aggressive interrogation techniques,
yes,
torture, waterboarding, whatever you wish to call it. So he's got a lot of baggage. I mean, it's true. I think he has President Obama's trust, but I mean, I think when you have a somewhat of Senator Feinstein's clout, you can't trifle with that. I get to be cynical for a moment. Maybe the only thing that saves John Brennan is a Republican takeover of the Senate in November. But eight months is a long time for this sort of thing to drag out, even though it's dragged out for 5 years already.
Yeah, my view is that Feinstein's more important to President Obama at this point than John Brennan is. He can't. I mean, she's going to be there, and Brennan can be easily replaced. Well, there was a special election in Florida for a House of Representatives seats. This is on the west coast of Florida, St. Petersburg area. A lot of retired people there, very sunny. A Republican won. You hear different interpretations of this election and how it happened. And I'll give you mine quickly. And that is that this was a district that was won twice by President Obama, because he won Florida twice and won this district. The Democrats had a great candidate, Alex Sink, who'd run for governor and had won the district as well when she ran and lost narrowly for governor in 2010. The Republican candidate, actually, the officials in Washington who were working on House campaigns repudiated the Republican candidate David Jolly in the press. They did it anonymously because they thought he was running a terrible race. They expected the Republican to lose, the Democrat would win. And of course, the Republican won. And the biggest issue he used was the president's health care program, which, as we all know, has had a very a clumsy and difficult rollout here going back to last October. What's your interpretation of this race? And the question is, I don't know, but look, the midterm election is in November. Whether this is predictive of what might happen there, I don't know.
Well, it's not clear, except that it's not a good omen. A loss is a loss is a loss. So the Democrats are furiously trying to spin away the fact that, as you say, a very formidable and talented candidate lost to a rank newcomer who didn't run a very good campaign. I think there are multiple factors, but I think there are a couple of things that cannot be denied. I think the main one is that President Obama remains very unpopular. I think just as a lot of voters in 2010 decided to send a message to the new president 2 years into his term because they were unhappy about certain things, I think a lot of Florida voters did the same thing. And I think Obama's unpopularity is a factor. There's no way to sugarcoat it. The other thing I think, Fred, is that in off-year elections like 2014, the out of power party is always more motivated. The turnout here was about 50,000 voters, fewer than 2 years ago, a real drop-off. Mm-hmm. And it's very clear that going into the November elections, mm-hmm. Republicans are energized. Mm-hmm. They're angry at President Obama. They're angry at the so-called Obamacare. And Democrats are disheartened, dispirited. And so a turnout in these sorts of elections is very important. I think turnout's going to be important in the fall. I think there's no way the Democrats can win the House, but I think these are inconclusive. It's an inconclusive outcome, but it's not a good one for Democrats.
Mm-hmm. You know, David, they have these special elections in between elections in Britain, and I suspect they may be overinterpreted there as they are here.
And I would say I did actually go down and cover this race last month, and I interviewed both candidates.
Yes.
The Democratic candidate was actually terrible. She's very awkward. She did run for governor, but she's a terrible candidate. Mm-hmm. And actually, David Jolly, the candidate who won, who's a lobbyist, he's actually pretty good on the stump.
Mm-hmm.
I would also say I think Obamacare was the big issue, and I think what's frightening for Democrats is their plan to deal with this unpopular health law was to say the extreme position, the Republican position, is to scrap this law completely. We want to fix it. That was the message the Democrats were using in this seat. It didn't work. But look, it's an incredibly white seat, almost 90% white. That's very unusual. It's a very old seat, massively full of pensioners. Turnout was extremely low. It was 180,000 votes, whereas it was 340,000 people voted in the general election. So you can't overinterpret it, but I think that strategy of defending Obamacare by saying fix, don't repeal, that was tested and it didn't work particularly well in that district.
Well, David,
and that's pretty scary for Democrats.
You've proved once again it's a rule of journalism is that there's no substitute for reporting.
Get on the plane.
Yes. All right. That's all the time we have. Join us today. It was Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal, and David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. This program was produced by Carol Castile. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Thanks for listening.
From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Issues in the News. You can email your questions or comments to our panelists. Send them to voanews@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune in the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us next week at this time for Issues in the News.